Good morning. We're delighted to welcome Mid-State Technical College students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we are also delighted to welcome Williams Bay High School students. Would they please stand, please? Thank you all for coming. At least the high school students are here with the national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they do join us, then they've been sent briefs in the case we're about to hear and may have engaged in activities in addition to reading the briefs. When they come, they will stay, if they have time, for a presentation with a justice of this court. And everybody is welcome to that discussion after the conclusion of this case. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. If anyone would like a synopsis of the facts and the statement of the legal issue in this case, if you raise your hand, the marshal will distribute a summary to you. It's better to understand this case if you have the facts and the legal principles involved. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Louis Prosser. He is...
Who? I think we morphed
you. Justice on the court now.
I think I've combined...
Vote. Yeah, that's all you get.
I've combined two justices. Justice Louis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. And I was very anxious to get to Justice Prosser because he is the justice with whom you will meet at noon today. Seated next to me, to my right, is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Seated to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And to her left, Justice Annette Ziegler. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. I'll now call 2006 AP 2254 CR State versus Carmen Doss. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney Jeffrey Kessel. And arguing for Ms. Doss will be Attorney Robert Hennig. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Carmen Doss was the personal representative of her father's estate. She was convicted by a jury of theft by a trustee after she closed the estate's bank account, deposited the estate's money in her personal account, withdrew the funds in cash, and disobeyed the probate court's order to return the cash. The Court of Appeals reversed Doss's conviction. It held that the use of certifications by the bank records custodians to establish the foundation for the bank records was improper under Section 89124 of the statutes, and that it violated Doss's right to confrontation. Whether the bank records were admissible, both under the statute and under the confrontation clause, is the issue that the state raised in its petition for review. In her Supreme Court response brief, Ms. Doss briefed a number of other issues that she raised in the Court of Appeals, but which the Court of Appeals did not decide, found it unnecessary to decide.
They had already decided the determinative issue.
They decided that she was entitled to a new trial because
of
the
admission. You agree all these issues then are before us appropriately?
They are appropriately before the court, and it was appropriate for Doss to brief them.
Before we proceed further, this morning, the court was advised that attorney for the petitioner.
No, for the for
facts,
the,
pardon me?
Attorney for the appellant.
Appellant, okay. Motion says the record needs to be corrected. That's what the motion is. You've seen the motion?
I have not seen the motion. Mr. Hennick gave me the records themselves this morning that appear to be the certification.
And it says while the index of the record transmitted by the circuit court includes exhibit list R34, the state's opening brief states the circuit court did not, in fact, transmit the trial exhibits, and that apparently the Milwaukee Circuit Court clerk retains the exhibits unless specifically requested to be transmitted, and that the case made it all the way through the Court of Appeals without the original exhibits, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So my question to you is, one, do you have any objection to the exhibits?
No.
Pardon me?
No, Your Honor.
So if we call them up, you don't object?
No.
Do you think we need them?
I think they're helpful looking at them. They are exactly what one would expect a bank records custodian certification to be. And
the actual records?
Excuse me?
And the actual bank records?
I don't know if that was the subject of Mr. Hennick's motion or not.
Well, what is it? Well, we can ask him. But do you object if the subject is the actual bank records?
Oh, certainly
you
not.
Don't
anything that
perfectly
was
perfectly okay. You don't think that they're necessary because you think that on the basis of these briefs we can decide the sufficiency of the evidence? Is that your point?
Yes.
Okay.
And the records themselves don't go to the point that Mr. Hennick was making in his sufficiency of the argument.
Okay. I have another question for you before we proceed, and that is, on what basis were these records subpoenaed? Were they given to the state before trial?
Given to the state or to the defense?
The state must have subpoenaed
them. The state subpoenaed them.
Under what?
Right. And the state...
Is the subpoena in the record?
I don't recall seeing it in the record, no.
Okay.
And I've reviewed the record. So
were they received by the state before the trial?
Yes, in fact, there are two sets of bank records. There was testimony at the preliminary hearing. In fact, if you go back to the complaint, the investigator in the complaint averred that he had reviewed the bank records. Some of the bank records, although not all that were used at a trial, were admitted during the state's case in the preliminary hearing. The out-of-state bank records, the SunTrust records, were provided in discovery to the defense, I want to say either 7 months or many months before trial. They were provided as images on a CD-ROM, is my understanding.
No challenge is made to the subpoena here?
No.
Okay.
And the other bank involved was M&I. And again, I believe some M&I records were recently referenced in the complaint and at the preliminary hearing. They were turned over to the defense, I want to say 10 days, it was more than a week before trial.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these are all records of accounts that the defendant owned or controlled as trustee.
They're the defendant's records. Okay.
Yes.
And the out-of-state ones were turned over about 7 months before trial, and the M&I about 3 days before trial,
no.
Or not?
More than a week.
Okay, more than a week. Okay.
I think it's 10 or 11 days.
But 3 days was the notice given that you were not going to have a live person or
right.
persons
yeah.
in the courtroom.
At a earlier pretrial hearing, the assistant district attorney had notified the court and opposing counsel that we're having some trouble getting cooperation from the SunTrust Bank, which is headquartered in Florida. But it was not until the Friday before the Monday start of trial that the prosecutor said, we are therefore going to be, we're unable to get them to attend, and we're therefore going to be relying on the certifications in lieu of live testimony to establish the foundation. All of the state's petition for review and the Court of Appeals decision addresses both statutory and constitutional issues relating to the admission of the bank records. It's the constitutional issue that has the broader ramifications here. That is because Section 891.24, which has been on the books since 1881, applies only to financial institution records. But 2 years ago, a new rule of evidence, Section 909.0212, was adopted that creates a self-authentication provision for all business records, not just financial institution records, that permits the foundation to be established through a certification of a records custodian. So the resolution of the confrontation issue in this case will determine whether the state, in a criminal case, is able to rely on that self-authentication procedure, not just in Section 891.24, but also in Section 909.0212. The resolution of the confrontation issue turns on whether a record custodian's certification of business records is testimonial. Das's argument that it is testimonial has the virtue of simplicity. She says it's an affidavit, it establishes facts, it's made in anticipation of trial. But the Confrontation Clause does not, in its text, provide a checklist for determining when an out-of-court statement falls within the ambit of the clause. To do that, it's necessary to do what the Supreme Court did in Crawford, and that is to examine the purpose of the right to confrontation and the evils at which the Confrontation Clause is directed. When courts around the country, and there have been numerous cases by now cited in the state's brief, including the Seventh Circuit, when the courts have looked at the purpose of the Confrontation Clause, looked at the nature of the underlying records and the nature of the certification, those courts, almost without exception, have concluded that the records custodian's certification is not testimonial, even though it takes the form of an affidavit, even though it is prepared for use in litigation. And that is because the courts have concluded, and correctly so in the state's view,
would you come to the same conclusion if there was a challenge that these records aren't correct, or that these records were not kept in order, or they've been altered, or any challenge to the substance of the record? Suppose the defendant challenged the records. These are not mine. They show erroneous deposits. They show erroneous withdrawals. The bank has confused this with another estate with the name of DOSE instead of DOSS.
I don't think that would matter. I think in terms of
how does the defendant then say these records are wrong?
Well, the defendant has had these records in this case.
Well, they can say that the defendant had these records and the defendant complained to the bank. The bank changed it, and the bank has produced the first incorrect record instead of the second correct records. How does the defendant bring that out? The defendant can't be forced to take the stand.
No, but the defendant could.
Right. So who's going to say that?
A defense investigator could certainly say, I've looked at the records, I've compared them, this has got the wrong name, the wrong address.
Burden of proof is on you, not on the defendant. Burden of proof to show these records are correct are on you.
Right, and the affidavit does that. And, you know,
regardless of what my complaint is about the records, you don't have to bring in somebody from the bank.
That's correct.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Castle. I'm looking at, let's assume, I understand your argument about the confrontation clause and whether or not a custodian's testimony may or may not be testimonial. But you still have paragraphs 16 and 17 of the Court of Appeals opinion dealing with the statutory requirements, providing that the books be open to inspection of all parties to the action of proceeding. And as I understand the facts here, at least initially, there was this representation that there was going to be a live witness until the Friday before the Monday trial, and that's when things shifted. And that's one of the things that the Court of Appeals focused on, that the statute wasn't required. Why doesn't that govern this matter?
Well, the Court of Appeals, of course, reversed on both grounds.
Right.
And I guess I'll preface my answer by saying, even if this court agrees with the Court of Appeals and Ms. Das on the statutory grounds, I think it's important to reach the confrontation issue because the Court of Appeals decision is a published decision. And for now, as that stands, the confrontation clause bars the use of these certifications, statutory issues apart. Justice Butler, you ask, were the statutory requirements met? Now, the answer, I think, in this case is yes, for a number of reasons. One, are the records, the originals, open to Ms. Das's inspection? I think there are several reasons they were. First and foremost is because they were her own records. Now, I think if we had a case in which the records sought to be introduced were those of a third party, and 3 days before trial, the prosecutor said, I'm going to be introducing bank records of the victim. I think there might be a stronger argument there. But were these...
Don't we have another case where the state's arguing that the records don't belong to the individual, they belong to the bank? We have a case pending right now to that respect.
I don't know the answer to that. But whether, regardless of who they belong to, she had a right of access.
All right.
So in terms of being open to inspection, she, as the owner of the account, either in her individual capacity or her capacity as personal representative, she had a right to inspect. She didn't have to get a subpoena. She just would say to the bank, I want to see my records. I will say, just as an aside, the statute itself clearly is a throwback to the days in which records were kept by hand, because it refers to cross-outs and interdelineations, and when the copies made would have been handmade copies. And it's an interesting question, one not presented by the facts of this case. What do the originals of bank records even mean these days when records are kept as scanned images and the paper may or may not be kept? But I think the fact that these were her own records, that it was clear from the outset of the case that they were going to be used as evidenced by the state, that copies were provided so that if there was any question about their authenticity, she could have at any point said, I need to check with my bank. So I think a different factual scenario, maybe the Friday beforehand, would not be sufficient. Under this scenario, it does.
Counsel, I was surprised when I read the Court of Appeals decision. They relied on Crawford, which, of course, is the key case, but didn't rely on any other cases interpreting and applying Crawford. And as we all know, the key case might be directly on point on all fours, and that's the end of the discussion. But, I mean, Crawford isn't directly on point on all fours. I didn't bring in my Court of Appeals briefs. Was it argued to the Court of Appeals that there's a multitude of cases going the other way by the federal courts? And what are the state courts doing? I think you cite an Arizona case, if I remember correctly.
The answer is that, unfortunately, I did not brief the case in the Court of Appeals, but
someone briefed him on behalf of the state.
And neither side brought in any cases. It was strictly Crawford and maybe Manuel. So the Court of Appeals would have been aware of these cases only had it done its own research. And I'm sorry, you had another question,
I thought? No, yeah, I do have another question. The harmless error in the Court of Appeals, the way I read it, which is not the only way it could be read, is that the authenticating records that are essential are not can't be harmless error. But I'm not so sure that the statutory violation, that is, that you didn't give them enough notice, that the Court of Appeals ruled on that issue as to harmless error. How do you read the Court of Appeals? Or don't we know?
My recollection is that its mention of the harmless error was in the confrontation
clause. That's the way I read it, but I suppose you could.
Whether they
okay.
meant to say that it carries over, I think, would be reasonable. We have not argued harmless error.
Because you don't think there's an error.
We don't think there's an error, but we often will make the backup argument. And the reason we didn't make the harmless error argument is for the reason the Court of Appeals pointed out. Clearly, these records themselves were critical to the state's case.
The state said that at trial.
Right. I will note, and I mentioned this case to opposing counsel this morning, there is a very recent Third Circuit case that has a harmless error argument in this precise context. It's United States versus Jimenez, 513 F3rd 62.
Pardon me, would you cite that again?
513 F3rd 62. Third Circuit, 2008. And I'll preface my remarks by saying I'm not sure I find, much as their analysis would help the state here, I'm not sure I find it a persuasive analysis. But the Third Circuit said we don't need to decide whether the custodian's affidavits are testimonial or not. It cited Ellis, recognizing that other courts have, because it said the certifications themselves did not provide any substantive evidence against the defendant. It was the underlying records. That analysis would apply here. As I said, I'm not persuaded that that's a correct analysis.
Isn't that your analysis as to why Crawford doesn't apply, that the certification isn't substantive evidence?
That's right.
So you would say it doesn't go to harmless error. It goes to the fact there's no error. Okay, I got it.
There's no error, right. Because clearly without the certifications, the records wouldn't have come in. And that's why I have not argued harmless error.
Counsel, I think Crawford arguably is much broader, as you indicated earlier, than just the statute that we have before us today dealing with evidence from financial institutions, but that it also implicates not only 90902.12, which you referenced as the self-authentication for business records that is of rather recent vintage, the statute is, but even the regular records exception to the hearsay rule that has been on the books in this state and in many states for a long time. That, I think, I think that Crawford would hold that statute a violation of the right to confrontation even before 990.02.12 because of this. We're arguing about a couple of things. You have, first of all, authentication. Old statute, you know, you needed under 90803 sub 6, you needed a custodian to come in or other qualified person for authentication. There was never a need that the custodian knew anything about what was in those records. The custodian could have 1,000 pieces of paper and not know the substance of anything. All the custodian had to do to get those records into evidence to prove the truth of the matter asserted or negate the truth of the matter asserted is to say, look, these records were kept in the regular course of business, if you think. The records were made by a person at or near the time of the event recorded. It is the regular course of business for this organization to keep such records. And these records were kept in that ordinary course of business. That's all the custodian needed to show. And because of the way that this hearsay exception has evolved over time, that's enough. Then that stuff, those 1,000 pages, are admitted into evidence because it's an exception, because it's deemed that there's sufficient indicia of trustworthiness as this law has evolved. I'm talking about 90803, okay? So wouldn't under the argument of the applicability of Crawford, there be a violation of confrontation, not just with regard to the custodian, or not just with regard to whether or not there was an affidavit in lieu of custodian, but the very rule, whether it's the financial records rule or it is the time-honored, which goes back 300 or 400 years in terms of development in common law, or at least 300 years in development common law, 90803 sub 6. Doesn't Crawford do away with that because those records can come in without anyone offering those records knowing about what's in those records?
And the answer is, and I think as I answered this, this is a better answer to the Chief Justice's earlier question.
Well, the setup is better, yes. Counsel.
Crawford itself recognizes that business records are not testimonial, right, in Crawford. And I think the reason was, because as you said, it is of ancient origin. It was recognized under the common law as
304. I mean, I used to remember the date, but it was an ancient shopkeeper's rule. That's how, in Wisconsin, 908.036 evolved, right?
So you're saying it was... It preceded the constitutional confrontation clause. Right. Therefore, the clause has to have accepted that.
And that's what Crawford said. And in Manuel, the court recognized that Crawford said. And I think that goes, now I see my time is up.
You may finish the sentence, please.
To the question, Chief, that you asked about who can you ask about the certification. Well, the same question is, more importantly, who can you ask about the records? That's got the substantive evidence, and we recognize and accept under Crawford that there doesn't have to be a live witness to be questioned about those.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hennick, representing the defendant, Carmen Doss. I'm assuming, counsel, that you preserve all the other issues on your brief.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Carmen Doss on this appeal. Excuse me. The central issue before this court, effectively, is whether the U.S. Supreme Court in Crawford and this court in Manuel meant what they said when they defined what is meant by a testimonial statement. Or on the other hand, whether the state is correct that effectively there is some kind of a prosecutorial convenience exception to that standard. Under Crawford, if you have testimonial hearsay, the confrontation clause kicks in, and you have two requirements. It's only admissible if, number one, the declarant is unavailable. Number two, the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine. So the question, obviously, since Ms. Doss had no opportunity to cross-examine these people, and they were not, in fact, unavailable, is whether these business record certifications are, in fact, testimonial, or whether they are some kind of non-testimonial type evidence. And that, I believe, is actually decided by the standard set forth in Crawford. In Crawford, something is testimonial if it is a solemn declaration or affirmation made for the purpose of establishing or proving some fact. What we have here is a certification in affidavit form sworn before a notary public, the purpose of which is to establish certain facts, the facts being the authenticity of these supposed bank records and to establish the admissibility under the business records exception. The court in Crawford also made clear that there were certain formulations of, you know, this core class of testimonial evidence. Included within those three formulations are, number one, ex parte in court testimony or its functional equivalent, such as affidavits that are offered to prove facts. Second, extrajudicial statements contained in formalized testimonial materials, such as affidavits. Or three, statements that are made under circumstances that a reasonable person would understand would result in their admission in court. Now, what's interesting, and I think what is critical here today, is that the state does not dispute that a straightforward, faithful application of Crawford's definition of testimonial statements, under that, these certifications, these affidavits, would in fact be testimonial. What the state is arguing instead is that there is some unstated, implicit exception to the standard that the Supreme Court actually stated in Crawford and that this court adopted in Manuel. And I have to admit that there are a number of cases out there that the state does cite to this court that seem to buy into that argument. However, as anyone who's ever read Charles McKay's book from the early 1800s, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, the fact that a number of people profess to a certain belief doesn't make it accurate.
Well, Mr. Hennick, let me ask you a question, and then it's kind of a follow-up to the Chief's question of Mr. Castle earlier, and it kind of goes to the question of harmless error. Granted, for purposes of this question, that this court were to say that the Confrontation Clause applies to a custodian testimony for purposes of admissibility of the records in question. You do not dispute, do you, that the records themselves are non-testimonial?
Correct.
All right. So we're talking about non-testimonial records. It would seem to me that the real issue that would confront a court if the custodian were not there, as I see a custodian, it's kind of like a chain of custody issue. Are we really dealing with the records in question? Are these the records? Are they the is there any dispute as to what's in the records, as to whether or not the records are what they purport to be? Unless there's a battle about the records themselves, that these are in fact not the correct records, or unless there's something to indicate that the records that were introduced at trial were somehow incomplete, false, or something else, why does this not fall under the harmless error standard, and why is this really a problem under the circumstances of this case?
Well, the issue here, it can be analogized to, for instance, multiple hearsay, where the supposed business records, and I would just qualify my earlier statement, they are only business records if they are established to be business records. So we still have to have a second level, which is evidence that establishes that these purported bank records, in fact, meet the authentication and foundational requirements for business records. But we have essentially multiple hearsay. We have the business records themselves that even if they are do qualify as business records, we have the qualifying affidavits that are the second level of hearsay. So both levels have to be admissible for the bottom level to be admissible as well. Also, in talking about whether the underlying bank records, in fact, were accurate and authentic, effectively, that's the same question in, for instance, a Miranda case, where you're asking whether or not a statement, an un-Mirandized statement, should be admitted. And we never ask, well, is that statement accurate? And if that statement is accurate, then we don't worry about whether there was adequate basis to admit it. What we have to do is go through the analysis, of whether this evidence was properly admitted, because if it wasn't properly admitted, then it can't be considered at all in a harmless error analysis. Doesn't matter whether it in fact was accurate. Doesn't matter whether that Mirandized statement or un-Mirandized statement in fact was accurate. If it was improperly admitted, if the state did not meet its burden of showing that it is admissible, then it cannot be considered in a harmless error analysis.
Mr. Hennick, the bank person who came from the can't discuss, because they don't know the records, other than to say this is what's in the bank, that this is what the bank has, why is it important that they be there personally? What can you examine them on? I mean, that's the whole point about Crawford, right?
Yes.
To give the defendant an opportunity to cross-examine and not be just left with paper stuff, right? So what could you have said to the bank person that would affect your case? And I gave the position of where the bank had all this on the DOS file, but then they had mistaken two files, just switched them. The bank comes in and says, yes, that is their file, and that is their file, but they forget to tell you there's another file. What can you say to this affidavit person?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
As in any case, you can cross-examine on whether what they actually say in court is accurate, whether, in fact, this custodian, who, although he doesn't know anything about how the underlying records were created, you can examine to test that custodian's actual efforts to go through the records to make sure that the records were accurate, whether they overlooked anything, whether they could have overlooked anything, whether what steps they took to make sure that they have everything and that these aren't just a limited group of records that, due to laziness or ignorance, this is all they pulled out. And those are kind of things that you can actually analyze. Now, in any given case, does that necessarily make a difference? Probably not. And I can tell you that Judge LaMalis specifically mentioned that she had never seen a custodian even be cross-examined in her cases. So the vast majority of cases, whatever rule this court comes up with, probably won't make a difference because people aren't going to come in and actually examine the custodian. But in those cases where it can make a difference, it's critical that the defendant have an opportunity to do that.
Should we say to the defendant, if you want to cross-examine this custodian, that the defendant has to say, yeah, we want to examine him, and then if that's what the defendant says, then you force the state to bring him in. But why force the state to bring him in every case? Because the rule that you want the court to adopt would force the custodian to appear in every case.
Yes, unless there is a stipulation between the parties. Just as the state has to bring in a witness dealing with the blood alcohol level in every case, unless there is a stipulation. The state has to bring in evidence of the police officer who did the radar gun in every case, even if it's not really disputable. What I have real concern with is that we carve out types of testimonial statements or testimony and say that the defendant has to somehow assert the right before trial rather than what we've always done, which is the defendant has a right to cross-examine whoever whatever witnesses are presented. And one of the things to keep in mind is the state specifically refers to the affidavits of a custodian. But think of the logical extension of that. He's saying that that's not testimonial. But if the affidavit isn't testimonial, then neither is the in-court testimony of that custodian testimonial.
Mr. Hennick, let me ask you this. Was 909.02.12, the self-authentication statute, in effect at the time?
No, it was not.
All right, let's assume for a minute that it was in effect. My understanding of your argument, at least earlier, was that it's the affidavit that was testimonial. Would the state be in better shape if they just didn't use an affidavit and just said these records are offered, they're self-authenticating, and we want you to admit them?
Well, I think under the new statute, you still have to have some kind of a certification or a verification or an affidavit, and I believe that has to be under oath. I don't remember specifically. But the Supreme Court in Davis, I believe it was, the state cites to that case more recently, specifically said that it doesn't make any difference. In that case, the police interviewed a witness, and after they interviewed the witness, they had her sign an affidavit. The Supreme Court said that affidavit is obviously testimonial evidence, and therefore it can't come in without the requirements of confrontation. But the Supreme Court there, Justice Scalia, said that just because it's not in the form of an affidavit, the earlier conversation doesn't come in. It doesn't become non-testimonial just because it's not sworn under oath. If it is a testimonial type statement, if it's offered for its truth and it's made in a circumstance where it's clear that it could be used at trial, then it's testimonial and the testimonial requirements therefore apply.
Mr. Hennick, the problem that I'm having with your argument is it appears, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that you're almost arguing that a harmless error analysis doesn't apply in a confrontation clause type setting. Because as I understand what you're saying that, look, if it should not have been admitted in the first instance, therefore it can't be harmless. And that seems to be a bit different from a situation where you have, because you've already conceded that the records are non-testimonial. This seems to be a bit different from a situation where there's a dispute about what the records contain or whether or not there's an error in the records or a problem with the records, where I would understand that, well, how can this not be harmless? But if there's no dispute about the records themselves, then the only real issue is the testimony of the affiant who prepared the records. And in the absence of a dispute about the records, if we accept your argument, that seems to in almost a circular fashion, say, therefore, harmless error doesn't apply. But we know under the Sixth Amendment, harmless error analysis does apply in a Sixth Amendment context.
Yes, if my argument suggested that, that certainly is not what I intended. The way harmless error works in a case like this is, number one, if the affidavit is not admissible as an affidavit because it violates the confrontation clause, then obviously the underlying there is no basis for admitting the underlying records because the foundation has not been established. Then the issue of harmlessness is whether the evidence minus those bank records is so sufficient that it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that there would have been a conviction nonetheless.
Maybe I'm looking at it from a different perspective, but as I see it, accepting for purposes of this question that the records were erroneously admitted, isn't that what you focus on in determining harmless error? The impact of the erroneously admitted records in trial versus the records shouldn't have been admitted in the first place, and therefore you can't look beyond that.
I'm sorry, I don't.
But
I understand
harmless error, you look at a number of different factors, and I know that this court has had numerous discussions in the past, which we may have later today, about which harmless error analysis should apply. But in looking at it, and I look at the Van Arsdale case, and I look at the harmless error analysis that was applied by the U.S. Supreme Court in that case, what you focus on will determine whether or not the error is harmless. And if your focus is, since the evidence shouldn't have come in the first instance, therefore this is not harmless, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is the Nader-Harvey test, where you look at everything else that's there, and you accept that the evidence was erroneously admitted, but what is the harm? Because if the evidence is all correct, and if there's no dispute about what the evidence maintains, well, kind of a no harm. I'm assuming that's what Mr. Cass is going to stand up and say. No harm, no foul. And so we need to really kind of focus in on what it is we have to look at in determining whether or not applying the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause harmless error analysis, this error is prejudicial or not.
Well, I think it's a pretty radical departure from traditional harmless error analysis to say that even if evidence was improperly admitted, that we look to whether or not it's accurate and determine whether it's harmless that way. I don't see that as being any way consistent with Chapman or with Van Arsdale or any of the cases, the Supreme Court cases dealing with harmlessness. And we still have to say whether, but for the error, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there would have been the same result.
Your position is if evidence is admitted and it should have been excluded, then you have to say, would this jury verdict be upheld if you took out all this evidence? Was there sufficient evidence to support the jury verdict? Was there evidence that was it prejudicial? But the point is, prejudicial that's used in the terms of 90404, I think it is. And the state conceded that if you took out this evidence, the state has a real problem because it was essential to its case. So your test for harmless error is, well, if you took out this evidence, did this evidence contribute to the verdict? Yeah, because it was essential to the case. So it was error to admit it. Therefore, the error is prejudicial because it was essential to the case.
Exactly. Exactly. And
doesn't mean I agree with you, but I think that's your argument.
That is definitely my argument.
That's the state's argument too.
Well, they seem to admit that, at least on the constitutional issue. The statutory, they seem to be suggesting a different standard. The constitutional, they seem to be conceding that this is, in fact, harmful, if I am right. Now,
you make a good point about blood alcohol and numerous and the radar and probably numerous other proofs where the law would require that the state bring somebody in. But none of them are of ancient origin. None of them are in the... I mean, this Scalia's Crawford case is an original intent argument. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't apply to blood alcohol and radar. Well, but it does apply to business records.
Well, what Justice Scalia's analysis applied to with all due respect, has nothing to do with ancient or anything of that matter. What it has to do with whether or not something is testimonial. One of the things he referred to is during the reign of, I think it was Queen Mary, judges would do individual interrogations of witnesses, create depositions, and then those would be used in court. And he pointed out that even though those are ancient, they are in fact testimonial and therefore are not admissible under the Confrontation Clause without unavailability and an opportunity to cross-examine. There are other ancient type hearsay exceptions, I think.
Counsel, can I ask you, can you think of any document then that would be admissible based upon certification or any document that's currently admitted in court on a regular basis that could be admitted without a human there to testify about the certification or authentication. Do we need a witness now for every single document that's always submitted at every single trial?
Well, you have to establish a foundation for the documentary evidence. So absent a stipulation, I would say no, that the natural consequence or the necessary consequence of Crawford's definition as that testimonial statements include affidavits that are offered to establish facts, that in fact we would have to have a live witness. And again, keep in mind that if we say that those are not testimonial, then it necessarily follows that a witness in court attesting to the same facts, that also would not be testimonial.
Okay.
And the analysis would mean that,
Department of Transportation, someone needs to show up to testify about prior convictions, or someone would need to come in and testify what a judgment of conviction is in a felon in possession of a firearm case. I mean, typically people stipulate to those elements, but you'd want a clerk of court or someone from the department to come in on each of those cases.
Yes, under Crawford, that would be required.
Thank you.
Now, this.
Where does video conferencing fit into your argument?
I really have not thought of that, and I have no idea. I have not read the cases on that, so I really cannot comment intelligently on that.
But your position, I take it, is that this authenticating witness has to be there in court.
Well, the authenticating witness has to testify and be subject to cross-examination, I think is what Crawford requires. I haven't read the cases dealing with video conferencing, so I don't know exactly how that fits into the face-to-face, right to meet someone face-to-face.
So in this case, how many bank officials would have had to come in?
Two. One for SunTrust and one for M&I Bank.
One from Georgia and one from?
M&I Bank in Milwaukee.
Okay. And if the defendant had been shrewd enough to open an account in Dubai, you would have required the state to bring in a witness from Dubai or
the
Switzerland?
The state would have to meet the constitutional requirements, yes.
And if someone wanted to cross-examine someone on a transcript from a court hearing, the court reporter would have to come in and testify that that's the transcript from the court hearing?
No, I don't believe that that's true. There is a case, U.S. Supreme Court case from approximately 1916. It's not cited in any of the briefs here, but it is cited in Davis. It's a case called Dowell, and I'm sorry I do not have the citation for that. I can provide that to the court sometime later. The issue in that case, it was a Philippines case. The defendant was convicted. The case went up on appeal, and the court on appeal wanted the record. And the defendant, for some reason, argued that when the trial judge certified the record to the Court of Appeals or to the appellate court, that was some kind of a violation of the Confrontation Clause. The Supreme Court said, no, it's not, because it's not the actual trial. That might be the answer to your question. That case might be the answer to your question, but I don't know. There are differences there. There are distinctions there.
How do you spell the defendant's name in that case?
I believe it's Dowell. Dowell. Again, I apologize. I don't have that here.
All right.
Now, quickly, the rationale of the courts that have adopted the state's position in this case. Basically, there are three bases for trying to evade the requirements of the plain language of Crawford. The first is what we talked about before, that the underlying hearsay would fall within the business records exception, and that's not testimonial, so therefore the affidavits aren't testimonial. But that's like saying that a police officer who has an undercover agent overhears a co-conspirator statement. He can then just sign an affidavit saying, these are the circumstances that I heard it in, and that would not be testimonial because the underlying co-conspirator statement isn't testimonial. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The second rationale that is given is that these are just routine certifications. You're not really providing incriminating evidence against the defendant. And the problem with that is that it's an utterly meaningless distinction. If the state is offering evidence against a defendant at trial, it is part of the link in the chain to create a conviction. The state would not be offering the evidence unless it thought that this helped obtain a conviction. So these cases try to make a distinction, but there really isn't any way to say under that distinction what is testimonial and what isn't. I'd also note that in Fifth Amendment cases, where you use basically the same language in the Fifth Amendment case, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. That's virtually identical to the Sixth Amendment, which is in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. And in Fifth Amendment cases, the court has made absolutely clear that self-incriminating statements are not limited to ones that directly incriminate you, but also any evidence that provides a link in the chain. Now, and finally, the courts that have supported the state's position essentially have said what the court has brought up here, that it's, or some members of the court have brought up here, it's difficult to actually comply with the requirements of Crawford. But as this court noted more than 50 years ago in Pliu v. State, a hardship on the prosecution, quote, does not justify regard of the rights of the defendant in order to overcome the state's difficulty.
If for some reason the defendant had wanted to put into evidence those records, the defendant would have been able to rely on the certifications?
Yes. And the same thing in civil cases, they would be able to rely on certifications in civil cases because the right to confrontation is purely a right of the defendant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Mr. Castle.
Opened his argument by referring to what the state has proposed and what the courts in other jurisdictions have done is the prosecutorial inconvenience exception to Crawford and to the Confrontation Clause. And I want to stress that while there certainly would be prosecutorial inconvenience, that is absolutely not the state's rationale. If the Constitution requires it, then the state will do it, notwithstanding the difficulty or inconvenience.
He makes a point that, to me, has rings a little bit, or the ramifications of his point. It's this. I'm a defendant, and I have a right to confront something, right? And let's say records are introduced against me that are horrible for me. They cinch the case against me. And those records come in under the regular records exception. That evidence, which is the clinching evidence against me, is considered non-testimonial. So you go through this little, is it testimonial? And so there's no right of confrontation against this evidence that I want to say a word that I'm not going to say, that's really everything against me. But when you deal with this, what is probably in most instances really ancillary, A custodian, either by certificate or in presence, says, yes, these are our records. They were made at or near the time of the event recorded. They were made by someone, not me, but by someone with knowledge. And it's the regular business of our business to keep these kinds of records. And these records were kept in that regular business. That you have the right to confrontation about. I mean, that's the right you can, you know, but the stuff that's really going to do you in, you don't have any right for confrontation. What kind of sense does that make?
It doesn't make any, and I think that's why the Seventh Circuit in Ellis said it would be odd indeed to say that the business records can come in and be the damning evidence and say that the routine certification mm-hmm. that says, yeah, these are the records.
I think it's odd indeed, but it's also odd indeed to say the testimony sworn by the custodian witness is not testimony. That's a little odd indeed, too. What kind of hoops are we going through? I mean, you know, is testimony testimony? Well, then we're not focusing on what is the meaning of is. We're focusing on what the meaning of testimony is. Is testimony testimony? That seems a little odd, too.
Well, it is if testimonial has just kind of the ordinary connotation, then clearly the record custodian who takes the stand and testifies is giving testimony. But that's not the question for purposes of the Confrontation Clause. We still don't have a definition of what testimonial is. I mean, we have the Supreme Court saying in Crawford, well, we've got these three possibilities. We need not choose among them. We have the court in Davis still not saying we're coming up with a defining one. We have this court in Manuel saying, well, we're going to adopt the three formulations, but we recognize that these aren't written in stone.
Let me give in my hypothetical that the custodian gets up. The custodian has to say, as a foundation, one of the four foundation requirements, the records were made at or near the time of the event recorded. Let's say, in truth, the custodian doesn't know that. The custodian doesn't have a clue if that's true, and the defendant would like, and the defendant knows the custodian doesn't have it. Isn't there a right to confrontation? Isn't that testimony? Is it testimony only when the custodian is telling a lie, but not testimony when the custodian is telling the truth?
I think you're back to the first question, Mr. Castle.
I think we are back to that first question, is that the damning evidence, the substantive evidence, is the records themselves, that the custodian, that nobody in court is testifying to.
Justice Butler has a question.
So let me ask you this, and I have to confess, I did not go back and look, but I do now recall that with respect to the business records approach to the Confrontation Clause, that predates Crawford, that predates Ohio versus Roberts, and that goes back quite some time in our jurisprudence. To answer this question, should we go back and look at how the court handled the business records, the admissibility of business records under the Confrontation Clause as it was adopted prior to Crawford, prior to Ohio versus Roberts, and look at the traditional approach and whatever they did, apply that under the circumstances of this case?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know what they did, so
I don't know what they did either. So it's never.
It might make both of you nervous.
Don't ask a question you don't know the answer, and don't answer a question you don't know the answer to. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that what the history of the certification type procedure. I know in Wisconsin we have it going way back.
The reason I asked the question, and it seems to me that what Justice Scalia was attempting to do in Crawford and Hammond and Davis and we may see it in Giles in the near future, was he's going back and looking at how confrontation has been historically approached at the time that the Constitution was adopted. And it seems to me, if that seems to be the approach of the U.S. Supreme Court, that perhaps we should be looking at that approach, even in its old cases, in terms of how it has been adopted and handled prior to the sea change that occurred in Crawford.
In the abstract, that makes sense to me. That's certainly what the court did in
Crawford. They said members of this court and the academics suggest we revise our doctrine to reflect more accurately the original understanding of the clause, citing a variety of cases and a variety of law review articles, but they offer two proposals. First, testimonial, leaving the remainder to regulation by hearsay law, and second, an absolute bar to statements that are testimonial, absent prior opportunity to cross-examine. So the way they've set it up, only testimonial. And if it is testimonial, then you have to show declarant is not available. But that doesn't mean that's the only original understanding of the Constitution.
Right.
Castle.
Justice Prosser?
Mr. Castle, if you lose on the confrontation issue, is that retroactive?
Well, it certainly would apply to Ms. Das in this appeal. It's on direct appeal, if that's...
Could say people who are in prison raise this issue?
There was a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court just in the last few weeks on the retroactivity issue, and the court had said that in federal collateral proceedings it is not retroactive. As I recall, the court said we leave it to the states to make their own retroactivity rules. I would argue that it would not be retroactive, but
you could waive it. I mean, it could have been forfeited by not being raised.
Correct.
If you don't object, it's gone, right?
Right.
There was an objection here, I gather. What was the case? Was that Van Patten? Did it involve?
Yes, it was Danforth versus Washington, I believe.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassell. And Mr. Hennick, for your arguments today in a very interesting case involving testimonial evidence or non-testimonial, as the case may be. And that ends our hearing on 2006 AP 2254 CR State versus Das. The court's in recess until 1:30. The student should remain, and Justice Prosser will be out shortly.